now read a bunch of stuff on Islamic law. We'll be reading some more. Next class that I want to be reading a sort of a random selection from the actual primary sources on the law, which I always find quite a lot of fun. Let me start by what questions you have about what you've read or about Islamic law. An hour and 15 minutes worth of questions, I will then go on to give out various stuff about Islam. Do you have any questions?
Yes. So, we're going to be the meeting. You mentioned one scholar who said that the system of law that people are whether you feel like that. So, what are your thoughts?
Well, the law is the person of the prayer. And he's one of the major modern scholars. I believe he is not a Muslim, but is Arab in some sense or other. And his claim is, you have to go through a lot of this, but part of it is he claims that it essentially provided law for free rather than having to pay for it. That the Mufti was supposed to be offered here. That it tried to bring peace between parties rather than just one side being one side losing. That it was a system which routinely protected the poor against the rich and the powerful. A bunch of claims like that. And I'm suspicious that it may have been sort of a functioning system for a long time, but I'm suspicious in part because as far as I can tell, is the evidence for some of these claims is from one particular bit of it, namely the Ottoman Empire. There's a different source who reports some evidence on the question of rich versus poor kinds of stuff. And he's made the statement in general. But also because reading a lot of stuff, he's got access to it. He's got conclusions he wants to make. I actually put up an optional reading yesterday, which is not about Islamic law, but is about a lot. Because in one of his books, he makes an assertion about 19th century Western history, which is slapping law, essentially the opposite of truth. And he could have discovered that would happen out of the world quite easily. He says that somebody believes something, believes two things, and not only does that somebody not believe them, he did research on both of those subjects, and in both cases reports the opposite of the result of law. This is what Francis Paul, especially when you read the lack of law. So, a general problem that we face lots of the time is how to evaluate sources of information. Alright? It would be nice if every time you wanted to know anything, you could spend a year studying the subject and reading all the authorities, looking at all the evidence and practicing. And one of the skills that I think our educational system doesn't teach very well is the skill of evaluating sources of information on the internet. So, which is what you in practice have to do a lot of the time with book or listening to somebody to read. And one way of doing it is by how it's written. Is this person saying, well, I think such and such, but here's the evidence against it. Or is he saying, I think such and such, here's the evidence for it, here's the evidence for it, how can any reasonable person disagree with it? But another method that I find useful is if you can find somewhere where what he's writing about overlaps something you know or suggest. And you can then judge not the rest of what he's written, but him by that. So in this particular case, he made an assertion about Darwin and Galton, who were two prominent 19th century English intellectual figures. It sounded a little implausible to me. I looked up the information on the web and found it was actually false. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean he's lying, but it means either he's lying or he's not being very careful to make sure that what he said is true. And since what he said was in support of an argument he was making, that makes me automatically more suspicious because, of course, we like to believe and say things are important. So that's part of the reason why, while I find what he says very interesting and I'm trying to evaluate it, I don't entirely trust it. It looks to me as though he wants to claim that Islamic law was a very attractive system and it was smashed by the Western colonialists. That's sort of an oversimplification of the statement. His argument is attractive, an interesting argument, and in some ways I like it. I share some of his credit. And a different way of putting it is that it was smashed by the rise of the nation state. That's a more plausible description of the evidence he offers. And he, I think, would say that too, but he would say that was because the English sees India, and the Dutch sees Indonesia, and the French sees Algeria, and then they impose these Western things and say, I believe not one of those. And as I discussed in my chapter, the problem with that is the other. There's many of the other problems. I don't know enough about Persia or the Mughals, some of the other nations. Society. But the Ottoman Empire is an independent state until, what, just roughly World War I. It's a powerful independent state until, I suppose, the 1800-ish, maybe a little after that. You know, there are the gates of Vienna and whatever, in 16-something or other. So you can't really explain what happens to the Ottoman Empire by saying this is the Western portion of the Ottoman Empire. And it seems to me, I read the book on the Ottoman Empire that explained the sources by somebody else, and it just seems to me very hard to deny that the changes that he's objecting to in destroying the traditional system were happening in the Ottoman Empire at a point where it was still a powerful, successful state. That's why my conclusion is, first, I think he exaggerates how well it works because we're looking at it in great distance, and I know he wants to believe, but I could be wrong about that. But I also think that the right, if he's right, that the part of his account of what happened to it that's right, it is the rise of the nation state, which suppresses a system in which law was to a considerable extent out of the state's control. And then death. Now, how large the extent is very, very much an open question. Discuss that a little bit in the chapter. It's clear that in theory, it was out of the state's control. The theory of it, as I think I put an A somewhere in that chapter, is what English common law would be like if law professors ran the world. If the law professors ran the world, it wouldn't be the decisions of judges that made the common law, it would be the law reviewer. And in the traditional view of the Islamic system, the way a judge decides how to rule, ultimately is not to look at a statute, not to look at an order from the current ruler, but to look at the scholarly work of generations of scholars trying to figure out what legal rules are inspired by religious sources. And those scholars, some of them were also judges being paid by the state, many of them weren't. If anything, one has the impression in the literature that being a judge was regarded as a somewhat dubious activity for a scholar, but it was corrupting essentially. They're trying to have boundaries from the state, of course. So it was initially essentially a decentralized, one way of putting it is that one of the forms of law when observed is customary law. The customary level we'll see with the legal Somali, where people in society think they know what the legal rules are. This is what the gypsy get. People in society think they know what the legal rules are, even though they're not written down anywhere and nobody's got power to get to. And what you get in Jewish law and Islamic law is sort of halfway in. Because it's a literate society with writing stuff down, but what's writing down is not this person who has legal authority to make the law says such and such. No, there's no legal authority to make the law. It's God. You know, he's not writing any books. He's just tons of them. That's quite a lot of them. So rather it is the people who are very learned, who are experts in this elaborate scholarship, who know 10,000 or 50,000 or usually Hadith traditions. Each of them with its chain of authorities by which you say, so-and-so told so-and-so told so-and-so told so-and-so that Muhammad said such and such. And not only do they know the chain of authorities for each of those so-and-sos in that list, they can say, oh yes, he is, we are told by so-and-so that he is a very reliable book. Of course, now you can easily get. So there's an elaborate body of scholarship. In addition to which, after a while, they have to know everything written by the previous scholars. So it's a matter of a body of scholarship trying to deduce the law, and then clearly in theory, and Halak thinks perhaps correctly largely in practice, that determines what the court actually does. Right. So that's interesting, and you can certainly see that if you were a very powerful ruler, and your system was developing from a system, I mean, I like to define feudalism as a system where the critical resource is controlled at a fairly low level, making the ruler a coalition leader, essentially. And I would argue that if you looked at big city political machines in the U.S. A little over 100 years ago, Tammany Hall was the famous one in New York. If anybody wants to know about Tammany Hall, there's a wonderful book called Plunkett of Tammany Hall. Tammany Hall was a political machine that ran New York City for centuries. And Plunkett was a not quite top level, but a high up county hall. And when he was in semi-retirement, he was interviewed by an agent. And I believe the interviews are genuine. You can't prove it any interesting how much the newspaper man wrote, but I think it's really Plunkett. And he's giving a highly intelligent, somewhat tongue-in-cheek defense of the machine system. And it's a lot of fun, it's quite readable, but it gives you a picture of that work. And it's pretty clear, you know, how do you get power in Tammany Hall? Well, you get to the point where you can deliver the vote. You know, you do things for your neighbors, you get them to know you, and you can then go and say, look, I can deliver 23 votes from this little area in the next election. Well, yeah, that's pretty good. All right, we'll put you on the lower, lowest rank of our ladder and start up. So I think that the basic feudal patterns existed in lots of contexts other than medieval Europe. And it's basically a pattern. Medieval Europe, the key resource of heavy cavalry is knights, interesting. But the knights armed in service to the king. Right, I remember seeing a figure somewhere at some early day that the levy of the Duke of Normandy was larger than the levy of the king. The levy of the Duke of Normandy is the number of knights who observe. The Duke of Normandy owes knights to the King of France. He doesn't know everything. He owes a fixed number of knights. And if you added up all of the feudatories to the King of France, they add up to less. So in that system, in order for a king to be powerful, he's got to be a good soldier. And if you imagine that you're coming out of that into something like France in the, say, early 18th century or late 17th century, they taught them walk, they stayed as deep, the sun king, where huge amounts of resources are flowing through the central government, and the central government goes up and do whatever it wants. But one of the things they're going to want to do is to have some control over the courts. They're going to want to be able to say, well, you know, maybe our grandfathers fought the law, or maybe that scholar who's been dead for 150 years fought the law with that. But I decided in my wisdom, advised by my advisor, to be that to vote. So it seems plausible that as you develop something more like a modern centralized state, one result was pressure to shift the legal system away from a sort of a decentralized system in which the judges found out what the law was but came with scholars instead, towards something more like a system where the rule is open. And basically, as I read it, Halak's complaint against the modern Islamic system, which I think is probably right, because they aren't really reestablishing the old system. What they're really talking about doing is maintaining a state-centered legal system, but having the statutory law in that be copied from what some collection of the scholars said the law should be. And his view, which I think may well be correct, of what the English were doing in India, was that they were making a good faith effort from their standpoint to provide Islamic law for them, for the Muslims. India had a huge Muslim population, as well as what I can do. And I think that from their standpoint, they were saying, let's figure out what the Muslim law is, put it into our law books. But of course, Muslim law wasn't in the law books in that sense. It wasn't in statute. So therefore, they were replacing a much more flexible, decentralized system with something more like a modern system. And in fact, it's sort of interesting that they were in fact being less English as well as less Muslim. The English system wasn't really attached to the common law system. And therefore, the common law system was rather more than the traditional Islamic system than what they were supposed to be. And similarly to that, Tunisia and the French. I think Halak thinks perhaps correctly that the French in Algeria were with the Alassans about trying to twist things in order to defend themselves. But whether that's true or not, his basic mistake was the viewpoint shared by the colonial powers, by the post-colonial independent governments, and by the Islamists, which is, of course, the state-run legal system, and the only argument is what you do. And his view was made, well, it's clearly true in theory, and I don't think we know how true it was in practice, is that the legal system is not really run by the state. The state was enforcing rules, some rules enforced by God, some years in court that state. The state was appointing and paying the judge who was the last layer of that system, but the judge that was getting the law not from court orders from the state, not from the legislature, but from this body of scholarship. So, it's a very interesting claim. That's why private research is not interesting, but at the same time, it seems to me that given what he's arguing, you have the prejudice in favor of seeing that traditional system that is a really good system. That also means you have the prejudice in seeing it having been destroyed, because otherwise you'd have to defend the system, Islamic system. And my impression, something he doesn't really discuss, it looks to me as though Saudi Arabia is the closest thing to the traditional system that's still around. So my understanding is the House of Saud does not in fact control the law. But the House of Saud controls the state, controls the government, but that there are other players in that system who dominate for the result. Now I think they have only a single school of law, so I don't think it seems as diverse as the traditional system was. Basically, the Saudis are coming out. One of the patterns you see in Islamic history is that from time to time there is a sort of a curative pattern. There is some group of people who say, look, all these people are corrupt, you're not really obeying the grand law, you're drinking wine, you're doing this, you're doing that, and we're going to persuade a lot of enthusiasts to really believe in this stuff again, and we're going to come out with it. That's happened repeatedly in Islamic history. And it's part of how this Muslim saying staying as long as they do, to the point of the great caliphs and the local rulers are basically not all that enthusiastic. You get North African revival movements, the Almohads, and the Almohads, who just sweep north and drive the Christians back into their mountains where they belong from that Muslim point of view, and then Mexico. Then things are crumbling in Mexico. But anyway, so I think the Saudi design standard is the most recent real example of this. So it's not sort of a fully traditional system, but I think it is a system, if I understand it correctly, which saves us a couple of Anyway, to answer your question, so his view is, he isn't really arguing that the legal rules of Greece are superior to modern legal rules, or that they aren't. That's not it. So he's rather arguing that the mechanism of the legal system. Legal system, which that protection of law was agreed on a system of court law, and it was fair and highest for the legal parties, and that it was designed less to give a winner and loser than to give a satisfaction. How much of that is true? I don't know. I'm not at all sure he knows, because it's not like we can go back and take films and what's going on in the 14th century. It probably varies a good deal from place to place. I have one of my favorite medieval Islamic law and econ stories, chapter, if I remember correctly, a couple, but one of them is this story about Ibn Hamna and the Caliph, where Ibn Hamna is a poet, and Khalif wants to reward him for a good poem. He says, the reward I want is that I be let off from the law against drunkenness. But he says, sorry, buddy, I can't do that. That's God's law, not mine. Right? I take the law. Name another reward. There is nothing else I desire. And so Khalif thinks of it, and then instructs to his officials that if anybody brings in Ibn Hamna, I'm found him dead drunk upon the table. He's to receive whatever it is. Or you master, I think the school has a smaller number of lashes. Usually some are at the law of the man, but whoever brings them in is the chief of the Alright? So that's the incentive to enforce this. Sort of one of my favorite stories is one of the threads that I'm interested in the different legal systems of what's the incentive to enforce. The beauty of that story is that it shows how even though the ruler has no authority over the law, he can de facto repeal a law that they And if you think about it, I mean, this is not just an ancient case. Obama, a while back, basically said, we're not going to try to enforce our laws against illegal immigrants, against a certain subset of illegal immigrants. Well, we approve of that. So we're facing that. As far as I'm not a lawyer, I'm like, that's all you're going to do, but as far as I know, Obama's got the power to do that. Okay, you know, we've got limited resources, we've got to decide what our priorities are. Obama, before he was elected, pretty strongly implied that he was going to do the same thing for medical marijuana, and he made on that promise. Now, Holder is in effect going back to saying we're not going to try to enforce the marijuana laws in states. You're going to medical marijuana in states. Medical marijuana or legal marijuana in states. legal marijuana, and again, he doesn't have to go to Congress to change the law to do anything. They choose to not enforce, and that's exactly it. So, that's why I think it's a neat story. It's a real thing. So anyway, with Hard Shell, you can certainly see that a sufficiently self-confident ruler could have a lot of effect on the law. He decides which he can appoint parties who say, yeah, I'll find some excuse in the law for doing what you want. And that's not that hard, because if you look at what's going on in the law, even within a single school, there are often several different opinions. And as time goes on, there's usually an opinion within the school about which of the school's opinion favor, but that's not really a binding one, so you're free to choose another one. There are a bunch of stories that I've heard with regard to Harun al-Rashid, about 800 AD, and Khalid, very famous Khalid, not one of his favorites. And there are stories in which he basically has a very clever judge, legal expert, and al-Rashid wants to do something illegal, and each time the judge figures out some clever way of working around the law. Stories, but they're basically tricks, legal tricks. And you can see that a ruler sufficiently determined to do that to have a lot of effect. In addition, as I discussed in the chapter, there are parts of the law, in addition to the pod and the sort of the three major categories, pod, jinniyat, and tajir, which are all part of fiqh, part of jurisprudence. There's also the parts of the law that are essentially being run by people appointed by the ruler. There's the police at their court. There's the inspector in the marketplace at his court. And all of them are supposed, in theory, to be sort of supporting what the law says, what the court in fiqh, but the actual rules are being made by them and by the ruler. So you can't tell whether 95% of the time it really was the law of the scholars, or 5% of the time there was something else in there. And Halak's argument, which again is not implausible, they may well be right, is that for a good deal of this time, the rulers themselves first. That the pattern you get, I'll go back to the position of this, and basically the pattern you get is that as the Abbasid Caliphate is breaking down, the second of the 9 weeks, that you end up with local rulers who are basically military leaders who were brought in a generation before while the Turks, while the demons occurred, and who have gotten power and are then referred to the Sultan or Prince or some other type. You know, you start out being the protector of the minor son of the guy who's supposed to be the real ruler, and after a while the minor son sort of goes away as the ruler. And that these people didn't care that much exactly what the law was, they cared a whole lot that the population see them as legitimate rulers. Therefore, the implicit deal was that the legists, the legal scholars, that sort of body of people who were viewed by the population as the authorities on the law would say, yes, so-and-so is a sultan, you should not uprise up against him, and the sultan would say, then all right, you get it. That's a long story. When it's true, actually, you have more questions. No, I'll do a little bit of a check here. So, what basically happens? Muhammad is a person of no great importance in Mecca. He is basically a caravan master for a while. He marries his employer, his widow, and that's a somewhat more important person, and he then starts seeing visions are of the angel Gabriel dictating very powerful poetry, Arabic poetry. And that's what
so at this time, what was the dominant religion?
The dominant religion would have been paganism. The Mecca was a pilgrimage site for the Arab pagans. There is something, the Kaaba, which I think is probably a meteor, I'm not sure, know for sure, but it was an object that became a structure, and that people from the Israeli area. So I think there was a multiple gods. However, there are also Jewish tribes in the area, and there are also Christians. So I think what's going on is that Mecca is predominantly pagan. Certainly there were Jewish tribes in Medina, which is not very far away. I don't know if there were Jewish tribes in Mecca, that they would have been very And I think if you look at the history, that Muhammad was helping himself to Jesus. And that it's only because the local Jewish tribe say, sorry about the requirements, that he then takes the position that he is a prophet in the same succession as the Jewish tribe. From the Muhammad, the Muslim viewpoint, is that they are part of the same tradition as Judaism. Other people's story. But that the Jews have gotten some of it wrong. The Jewish Testament has been distorted in transmission. So much of it is right. Not all of it. The Christians don't have a testament. Because they don't have a book of Jesus. All the Christians have are the accounts by the companions of Jesus. Well, that's not the Quran. That's the Hadith. That's the traditions of. So it's not surprising that the Christians got confused from the Muslim standpoint. So therefore, and of course from the Muslim standpoint, Jesus is a prophet. It's a very major prophet, maybe the second most important prophet, after the prophet. But he's not a God. He can't be, there's only one God. He's much more resolute than Imam Christianity is. That's also for eternity. So in any case, so Muhammad starts preaching this new religion and gets a certain amount of flack, but also confidence. And eventually his critics in Mecca become fairly serious, and he flees Mecca to Medina, by the way. I think he's been sending some of his converts to Medina already, if I remember correctly. And in Medina, he becomes the head of a community of people who convert, more or less everything converts except the Jewish tribes who are in Medina. We eventually board with the chief. And he then rules over Medina and in fact fights an on and off war with Mecca, which he eventually wins. So before Muhammad dies, he's got both Mecca and Medina under control, and his people have started spreading out, bringing other Bedouin tribes and starting conflict. Muhammad dies, and the decision is that Abu Bakr, who is maybe his closest supporter companion, is going to be the successor. And the successor is not thought of as having any special divine status anymore. It's just Muhammad. So that as far as I can tell from the Sunni standpoint, in a minute, the fact that one of the successors did something is evidence that it's right only because the successor is Muhammad, or the top by the structure of the Sunni, not as in Muhammad's case, but that they're doing. So Abu Bakr is the first successor. I don't think that's where he went, Abu Bakr, sorry. After Abu Bakr was chosen to be caliph, he said to his wife and daughter, now the Muslims will expect me to spend all of my time upon their business, and we will eat up all that we own. And so he got a bundle of cloaks and went to the marketplace to sell it, which is successful. And as he was on his way to the marketplace, he met Umar. And Umar said to him, whither away, Khalif? Abu Bakr said, I go to sell cloaks in the marketplace. But you are the Khalif of the Muslims. What are you doing going to sell cloaks in the marketplace? I'm the Khalif of the Muslims. My family must still eat. Come with me. Now, the Prophet used to say that if the devil met Umar in his path, the devil would climb a high hill and help. And so, Abu Bakr went. And he took it to the man and had charge over the treasure for Muslims. For Allah said, actually, merciful and been generous to the Muslims, and they had won battles and battles. And he said to them, here is our Khalif, what can you give him to clothe him and to feed him? And to clothe him, I can give him one garment in summer and one garment in winter, and others to replace them when they were. And for the rest, I can give him one exile. And not just out of a great man nor of a little man, but the middling one. And with that one chief, he stayed. And so, and Abu Bakr is dying, and he speaks to some of his companions. He says, what thinkest thou of Umar? Hey, speaking, do not claim. I learned the prophet used to say that Umar always spoke the truth, however harsh. And it was for that reason. So when Abu Bakr dies, he is. I should have, I've got somewhere readily available. Abu Bakr's will the vitamins were packaged out of the Umar. And, you know, if he behaves as I expect, it would be well, and if not, every God will do it. And so Umar becomes really. And the story is told of Umar. He is sitting by the threshold of his house with some of his companions, and a beautiful slave girl goes by, who is a part of the treasury of Louis. One of his companions, they are Then she is not lawful to me. Why is she not lawful to me? She is a part of the treasury of the Muslims. But you are the coming from the Muslims. What therefore is and is not lawful to you is the treasury of the Muslims. Talk to my passing place. But it's lawful to me with the treasury of the Muslims. And one exile came. Not that the great man or the blue man was a living story. The brother was a living story. That is all that is lawful to me. Part of the reason why in the story, but part of what's interesting about the early history, is I think it is clear that Abu Bakr and Umar are really that they have their priority is to do what they think wrong for that day. Umar is dying. His wife and daughter, I think, try to persuade him to stop fast. He said, I understand all that you say, but I have two companions who took leave of me in a certain text. I fear I don't have that fact. And so it's two neat paragraphs. Abu Bakr used to say his prayers softly, but Umar in a loud voice. And one day the prophet asked him why they did it so. Umar said, to wake the drowsy and scare away the devil. And thou, Abu Bakr, you guys speak to with him. So again, it's an interesting contrast of two very different men, but they. By the time Umar dies, I think the Muslims have probably conquered, I think, Egypt, Syria. They basically, I think by that point, they more or less annexed the Asiatic part of the Byzantine Empire. And they may have, by then, or shortly thereafter, annexed the Greeks.
So when you say conquered, do you mean like in a philosophical
no.
way?
No.
Or like by
military? Oh, yeah. Then part of what's really extraordinary about the whole story, if I were a Muslim and wanted to persuade you that God was on our side, what would be evidence for it, is in 600 AD, there are two great powers at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, the Byzantine Empire and the Sassanid Persian Empire. And they've been fighting each other forever. The Arabs are big players. There are some Arab kingdoms and principalities, some of which ally with the Byzantine, some of which ally with the Persian, some of which go back and forth. As far as I can tell, if you get as far south into Arabia as Mecca and Medina, they really aren't allied with anybody. Suddenly, you've got this religion about here, and within a generation, they have annexed one of the two great powers and half the other. Very impressive. North African political philosopher, 14th century, who has a book where he's discussing sort of his theory of scientific theory of politics, and how it goes back in a way to my fundamentalist theory. The theory is that you have some tribe that takes over power, but power is corrupting. That over time, because of the power, they stop only collecting the Quranic taxes and go to collecting other taxes. They start living in luxury. The ruler regards his closest relatives as a threat to him that he could take over power, so he gets rid of them. And that cuts the bonds of kinship that connect with the rest. So they're sort of rotting away through success. Meanwhile, out in the desert, there's another crop getting ready. So this is a sequence. And as Ibn Khaldun describes it, there's a lot of inertia in that process. So it takes a long time for. But he says, I've got a problem, I've got evidence against it. Because consider the initial triumph of Islam. In a single generation, they do all of these things. That seems the evidence against my son. Ah, he says, but that's all. Because we understand that these things were a miracle. For God put courage in the hearts of our people, and fear in the hearts of them, and as a well-established principle of philosophy, the scientific laws did not act with the The best way I've ever seen of explaining away but anyway, so it really was quite an extraordinary sequence. But Umar's successor is Osman. Osman, if I remember correctly, is himself a fairly early convert, but from a family which stay on the anti-Muslim, on the anti-Muhammad side until they basically lost. So he's left, as it were, part of the core. And it's pretty clear that Osman has a much broader view of what he's entitled to with the treasure of the Muslim than Umar has. And he sees, he probably believes in the religion, but you know, lots of people believe in a religion and still see their position as Pope or whatever as an opportunity to do well for themselves and their really opportunity. And eventually, he gets into a good deal of trouble with a lot of the sort of companions within from the beginning, and he gets back. And his successor is then, is then Ali, and that Ali is the central figure in his initiation. Because Ali is the cousin of Muhammad and is married to Muhammad's daughter. With the result that Ali's descendants are the only descendants. And the Shia position is that Ali should have been first. Rather than not. I think, my guess is that the Shia don't actually say that Abu Bakr is the So Ali becomes the fourth caliph instead. And Muawiyah, who is the nephew of Osman, the third caliph and governor of Syria, eventually refuses to accept the leadership of the civil war. And while the civil war isn't really settled, Ali gets assassinated. I think for reasons not directly related. Umar is assassinated too. There's a good deal of Muawiyah more or less buys out on these sons. They offer against the debts and stuff like that if they will not play the caliphate, and Muawiyah becomes the caliph. And he founds the great sons. So that sort of is the initial sequence. And eventually after 70 or 80 years, the Abbasids, who are another related family, raise a rebellion against the Umayyads. This is more or less does fit Ibn Khaldun's picture and sends the Umayyads as sort of a religious threat. Well, we are pretty really, as far as our religious view, is a very confident dialectic self-security. But by the time you're getting 70 years down the line, one or two of them are real believers, but a lot of them are just going to power. And the Abbasids, in part, strongly imply that they're going to support the Shia and they use the Shia as allies, but they then put themselves in the Khalid rather than whoever is the Shia. But let me keep going. Now what's happening over time is the Abbasid caliphate eventually starts getting weaker. It loses early on, it loses Western Islam to the surviving Umayyads. What happens is that one of the Abbasids try to murder all the Umayyads, and one of them gets away. And he makes it all the way to Muslim Spain. Muslim Spain, apparently a lot of the important people were Umayyad supporters. And so he raises an army there and makes himself ruler of Muslim Spain. And the Abbasid sends an army against him, he defeats it. So the result is, he doesn't actually claim the caliphate. So that after a while, you've got the Abbasid caliphate, which is sort of Syria, Iraq, Egypt, then Persia, that Middle East area. You've got the Western Umayyad caliphate, which is Spain and part of North Africa, where the exact time shifts over time, into them with the caliph claiming to be the proper successor. But it's unclear just how much any of these people rule. That it looks as though the definition of being part of the Abbasid caliphate is in the Friday prayers, you name the Abbasid caliph as a kind of commending as it were God. But I was struck reading a history of the Abbasid caliphate of a couple of interesting patterns. And one of the patterns you get a couple of times is that some important local leader is on the wrong side of the civil war, and he gets better out the rest of the country. And time passes, And the Byzantines invade, but the Byzantines are still there. They've lost modern Turkey. So the Byzantines invade, and the existing powers can't stop them. And so the caliph lets this local leader out. And troops flock to his banner, and he goes and he rides off. That sounds to me like really a system. Right? That's a system where the local leader has got resources that the ruler can't have. Therefore, when you don't need it, you can keep them on top, but when you do need it, you better. And the other story, which is related to this, is when Al-Rashid dies, Al-Rashid has two sons who both died easily. Al-Mamun is the younger, and I'm not forgetting this. Now, Al-Rashid, who I think is not very bright, but appoints the older one to be caliph, to be his successor. The younger one to be governor of the Eastern Province, and swears everybody in sight. Pretty soon, it's great. And the comment in the modern history I was reading in the Abbasid is that on the face of it, the older should have had all these. That he was caliph, the Eastern Province was in a rebellion in the old times, but they had to do a base. He only had one problem. And the problem was that when he sent an army to fight his brother, the army only had one competent general in it because all the others refused to go. Well, that again suggests that it was a lot less of a centralized authority structure. And Al-Mamun wins and becomes a very successful. It reminds me of Wu Wei, and neither of them takes itself. Al-Mamun is an enthusiastic chess player, but not a real one. And he used to say, I am the master of the world. And so that's past time. The master is stand square. So over time, you gradually develop a situation where the nominal caliph still exists, but doesn't have very much power. And they brought in Turkish and other mercenaries, and who are a good deal in sort of the military force, and they become powerful figures, and eventually. For quite a while, there's still a caliph sitting up there. Third dynasty, eventually Saladin, who is one of the, he's Kurdish, not Turkish, but he's one of the sort of military leaders, goes off to Egypt, supposedly to help the Fatimid caliph in Egypt, and after a while, there's no Fatimid caliph in Egypt itself. Put it together, that's the pattern. And then the theory, at least the Halakh is arguing, is that at least once you have the point where the rulers are not very closely connected to people, now it's important for them to have the support of religious legal scholars in order to give them legitimacy. And besides, they say, you know, if they aren't really local, they don't care that much what the law is. See more. Local people will be happier in the law they're used to, and you guys know what it is, so watch. You have the impression that the rulers might occasionally try to sort of keep things for some special benefit themselves, but mostly. So let me go back for a moment to the Sunni and the Sunni Shia. The initial view of the Shia, Shia is, I believe, the Arabic word means partisan. It's partisan. Supporters of Ali, and their position was that it should have gone, the Ali Caliphate should have gone to Ali officially, that there was a sort of a supernatural authority that passed down from the Prophet to Ali and then to his descendants, that eventually one of Ali's sons, if I remember correctly, Hussein, I think, or two sons, very similar names, ends up rebelling, trying to claim the caliphate, and gets killed by a movie of sons. And so you end up, for a while, the Shia are in effect trying to claim the caliphate, not doing it. Eventually, the Shia take the position, well, the caliphate is the secular rule, the Sunni have that, but the real position of authority is the imam, and he is the religious leader, the pope rather than the emperor. And that position goes through the descendants. The Shia, however, never had a principal predilection, although it was not clear which defendant he went to, and you got splits among the Shia according to who they thought was there. And eventually you end up with one group of Shia who held that there were seven imams, of whom the seventh went into occlusion. Any of you who are familiar with the story of King Arthur is carried away to be healed after his last battle and then remains in some fairyland, more or less, to come back when he's in. That's the occlusion. Because the occlusion imam is wandering among us. So the theory is that the seventh, or in a different line, has 12 of them, but either that the last imam, seventh or 12th, is still around, sort of invisibly, magically, keeping an eye on things, but, and so it's the family of the Iranian government, their sense of allegiance on the past. And he can still, from his hiding, help people, he can be very sustained, but we don't. And that is a thousand years ago. There are more than two divisions, because there are a couple of seveners sects and a couple of twelver sects, I think, according to which people they fought the line is. And the Fatimids were Shia, and they actually claimed to be Fatimids when they had politics in Egypt. Fatimid meant descendants of Fatima, who is the daughter of Muhammad. It's not clear if they really were Fatimids or not, but they claimed to be at least. Anyway, so the one place where that affects the law is that from the Sunni standpoint, really the sources of law are the Quran and the doings of Allah, and then consensus. From the Shia standpoint, you add to them the doings and sayings of the imam. So that from their standpoint, you had a source of divine inspiration for 200 years of longer. And as you know, that is a fair amount of majority. She, however, from the majority of Iman. Questions so far? Alright, next question is, where does the law come from? I try to distinguish in the chapter that you read between Sharia and that wasn't true in the previous draft. And not everybody makes that distinction. But I think it's a legitimate distinction that speech is law as the scholars have deduced it, and Sharia is law as it were in the mind of God as they should. And the distinction I tried to make in the chapter, in our pattern, is between constitutional law as defined by a constitutional law professor who decided to test the Supreme Court judgments, and constitutional law as defined by a Supreme Court justice who is making those judgments, therefore needs some other source of authority, whatever it is. That would include somebody who believes he was a strict interpretation, who would include them with a different theory, but the one thing he can't do is to say, this Constitution says whatever we say it says, because that doesn't tell him how to, if that's all he says, how does he try to say it? Right? So similar, but I think it's a useful distinction, and therefore, from that standpoint, all the people who say they want to institute Sharia, well, they may want to institute Sharia, but all they could is to Alright, so now I distinguish in the chapter and elsewhere between two different accounts of the history. And the traditional version, which may or may not be right, starts out with the Quran and the Hadith. Sometimes it refers to the Quran and the Sunnah. Sunnah is the practice of the Prophet, and the Hadith is the tradition of the Prophet. That's why it should be the Prophet. And to some extent, I think also Hadith about his companions, and there's then a period of a couple of centuries of interpretation in which You have, in addition to those sources, you've got independent reasoning, the reason to figure out the law, and you've got various interpretive strategies, such as analogy, such as saying, you know, that Quran says such and such, well, analogously, that Quran says such and such, that is clearly only one example. Or a fortiori, the Quran says you are not to yell at your parents, therefore you're certainly right. Things a variety of different, and just like we've got Canada's interpretation when they developed it. And by about 130 AH, AH means after Hijra, which is the date 622 when Muhammad goes from Mecca to Medina. And by 130 AH, so that would be about 750 AD, one book has about 600 editions. By the end of the second century, there's a compilation of different and by the end of the third century, you've got several scholars who put together what they consider authoritative, meaning that they're going through the 50,000 whatever and saying, well, this might well be too weird. This octopus is really good. And so they're getting it down to something in thousands of traditions which are really and then so therefore you're using the hadith as well as the Quran to figure out what it is. And then in addition there's the idea of consensus. And the idea of consensus is the theory that Muhammad says something to the effect that my people will never be here. What the claim is that if all of the legal scholars agree, the question is settled. And what that means is people don't agree. That the Maliki apparently took the position that all the legal scholars of Medina, of the city which was sort of the core city of the development of Islam, agreed that was it. Whereas some other people said, no, all of the scholars who existed at one time have to agree. And I gather there's also some question as to whether agree means say the rule is X, or he and he said it was X and nobody said it wasn't. But by some such basis, in the different schools with different opinions, you get the idea of certain issues. And you end up with four schools of law, which are mutually exclusive. Don't regard each other as heretical, but from their standpoint, each of them disagrees somewhat on the detailed rules of interpretation. They may disagree on which hadith they think they're sure is true or which ones they aren't. And the result is that you get one school where the punishment for drunkenness is 80 lashes and one other school is 40 lashes. On the issue they have to disagree with how many issues you need, whether or not women are circumcised. We have a lot of disagreements in detail, but on the whole, they are minor variants on. And the impression you get in the literature is that legal scholars don't really want it. That the judge is a little bit distracted. Yes, you're not making a respective authority. By this time, it's pretty well accepted that the ruler does not have to help. That is, the thing of the ruler is virtue, which is the thing of even good Muslims, it's the legal scholar. But you're supposed to obey sort of a gradual slide over time from the position that only, you know, really deserves to be made votes or whatever to the position of God gave power to obey. Although if you look at the law, one of the things that I link to discusses the case of rebels. And pretty clearly a rebel against the ruler is seen as it were as a legitimate civil war and not a treason. So there's some respect to the fact that they would disagree with the ruler. So then one of the questions which there's disagreement about is to what extent at some point they stop making the interpretation. So the view that some people argue, for which the phrase is closing the case of Ishtahad is the process of deducing a legal rule from the original legal sources. And a mushtahid is a scholar capable of it. Being a mushtahid is not like a PhD diploma in some of these issues. The factor of who's the highest means you have a college team growing up with your reputational system, not a formal system. So the argument some people make is that by about the end of the 10th century, pretty much everything was settled, and all the next generation scholars had to do was to follow the example of the previous scholars. They didn't have to do that. Other people would argue that that never happened, that presumably more things had been settled over time, but there were always new issues that came up. And there might also be people who said, well, I don't actually agree with what the best supported system in my school is, so I'm going to go back and do arguments. So, and it's an important issue, partly because of the question of what happens now. You look at the Islamic world at present, and you say, what are the options they have? Well, the option that some of them tried to take in the course of the 20th century was scrap Islamic law as it exists something. Yes. I think that's what we've got of the Shah in Iran. That's what the Ottomans in particular, where you have got it, you know, the Turkey is a revolt of sort of not quite top-level military people, led by Ataturk, which ends up establishing a government which is explicitly secular. They're not trying to eliminate Islam, but the position of that government is that Islam is not supposed to bring more governmental system, and that's now finally breaking down. The situation for most of the 20th century was basically that it was pretty clear that if somebody won an election in Turkey on a Islamist platform, he would be deposed by the president. And in the last decade or so, that arrangement was described. That's what they're saying here. But in any case, but that's one alternative. So we'd rather do it without. But another alternative, what I think most of the Islamists want, is to do a Western-style centralized state, but with legal rules which at least support your nation. They are based on. A third alternative might be to go back to what Halak thinks is the real traditional system, and nobody seems to know yet. But a fourth alternative would be to reopen the gates and to be able to close. Say, all right, we ought to have the legal rules that are implied by the Quran and Nahi, but we get to rethink what they are. And after all, the world is different than it was in the 10th century or the 9th century. We know more, they're facing different circumstances, so you can imagine a possibility in which they are, from their standpoint, still doing Muslim law, but it is revising. That's one reason it's not important whether or not you accept the claim, all the different questions are settled in the 10th century. What I've been giving you is sort of the official line. What most Muslims, certainly up to 100 years ago, and probably still, who knew much about the subject, there's a critical view of which the person is mostly associated with a man called Schatz, by the way, for somebody else a little bit earlier, and Schatz argued that story wasn't true, that that was a account invented after the fact to justify the law, but that isn't how it is. And this claim that is in the original system, Muhammad and the first four Khalifs, what you had were a few rules coming out of the Quran, a lot of rules that were basically existing custom in Mecca and Medina, after all, it was a functioning society before Muhammad was born, Bedouin law there, and maybe now Arabic law, I don't know if it's the same or not. And then as they expand, they're annexing Byzantine and Persian territory. That territory already has its own regulations to do ruling before. So you've got Muslims who are now ruling the territory, so what do they do? They are largely going to adopt the interstate rules living under. And you're thus developing a set of legal rules that nobody is doing. And you have judges who are being appointed, groups of the judges, especially in different cities, sort of talk to each other, come to some agreement with the lawyers, and you then have disputes among them. And one of the, maybe the central dispute was between people who said the only real source of law is God, and people who said there are other sources of law. So, yeah, the Osirites were sort of the other side, but it's still running at least by 800 or so. And a little bit later, on the question, one way they would put the question is, can human reason itself alone tell you anything about right or wrong? And the one side would say, no, we know that human reason is imperfect, therefore, in order to know things are right and wrong, you've got to go to the situation. Whereas the other would say, we'll find the situation is very good, we've got it, we can also do some stuff with it. So you get one body of legal scholars who are, to a considerable extent, trying to figure out what the law is, and another body who at least claims they got the law from the Quran. And then as Trump tells the story, it became clear over time that the divine authority argument always trumps, because this is decided within Islam, and therefore both sides are. How do you use the divine authority once you know what the law is you want to have, or even better, how do you just press the law? So his view, basically, is that not only, is everybody would agree that there were both sides. There's a quote somewhere from some medieval source, and nothing are learned men so prone to sin as in the invention of traditions. And you can see that if the traditions determine the law, there's a strong incentive to invent traditions. I think I have a story in this chapter. Traditions. So, in Shaw's view, but our existing body of traditions are almost all, maybe all, forgeries, which developed during these controversies with each side trying to create reasons to support their position. And so the rationalists, in effect, fell back on the Islamist position and said, yes, we agree with you, it's all hadith, but here is hadith and tradition for you. And that ends up, that some mix of those ends up being the and at that point, what they have then is the Quran, the hadith that they believe are real, and again, rules of interpretation. But they, in principle at least, rejected the idea of a rule that just consists of human reason, and the rules are all, in theory, rules about how you draw out from these religious sources. Yes. I really don't know. My impression is that the position that more or less everybody eventually accepts is that without God's help, we can't do it. I think that's and for a while, it was a very serious thing, kind of common. So then the evidence that Shank offered is that his claim at least is if you look at things that were written in the very early periods that were pretty clearly genuine, they don't mention these traditions for 100 years later. And that if you look at the doctrines of the schools, that they trace to people other than Muhammad, the early jurists, and that there are examples we know of legal decisions made in the early period that are inconsistent with what was later claimed. Clearly Muhammad's companions, the four well-guided caliphs, the first to live in the world, that they were people who knew Muhammad, they observed how he was running things, they would have gotten right. Therefore, their decisions are inconsistent with traditions. Whether he's right, I don't know. I did, a few years ago, get a text by someone on the other side who's been on an email list of people doing Islamic law, and I printed out 3 copies of it, and they're on the library on reserve. So if you want to read it, this is something he's arguing. And you've got a reading, I think, for next class. Of an essay which is discussing some of the evidence, not so much on that, but on the general question of how law develops. So we look at the works of different scholars in a single school to see what the process is. So that's sort of an interesting area. Alright, so now what's actually happening in the system, Let me try to run very briefly, and again, I hope you will think about the things you wanted to ask and talk about, just call me deep, that the classification of offenses is basically by the punishment, that you have the hot offenses, which are the offenses which have a specified punishment, and which are thought of as Quranic, although in at least one case, and maybe more than one, they're really based on practice of the early beliefs, not on the text. And then in addition to that, that's the hot offenses. The tazir offenses are offenses where the judge gets set penalty with the the tiniyat offenses are the ones which look to me like a blood feud system and bright support system. The tiniyat offenses are the offenses where if you kill or injure somebody, he, if he's alive or his kin is dead, then fine. So it looks like what we see later in Islamic law, a system where in effect assault and murder are thought of as torture. Then there are offenses against public policy with administrative rules, offenses are called siyasa, and also some offenses, some in these other categories, one of the implications is you have to do that. You have to do something which is not being punished, but you're sort of voluntarily doing things. And the hot offenses, the first of those is zina, which is unlawful intercourse. And the marriage rules basically are that a man can have up to four wives. I believe there is a tradition that the prophet said that you can only have more than one wife. So some people didn't argue with that. Wife is the usual tradition. So if you want to have four wives, and you can also have concubines. Concubines seem to be usually slaves, I'm not sure if they have to be slaves. And a woman can only have one wife. It is legitimate to have sex with your wife or your mom. And the illegitimate intercourse with what's called zina is a hot offense, and the penalty depends on whether the offender has or has not had the opportunity to legitimate. So if you're a married man and you have sex with somebody who's not your wife or concubine, you have committed a serious burden of breach. Whereas if you are an unmarried man, you've never had the opportunity to have legal sex, then it's still a crime that's not very serious. I mean, it'll and it's got to be voluntary. That the basic position is that a woman is raped is not going to be that, but of course you've got to be able to prove she was raped. So, so. And the penalty for the serious version of Zina is self-accepting. The accusers, I believe, have to prove for themselves. It is not in the Quran, but it was apparently in both Quran. Does not apply to slaves, does not apply to minors, although I'm pretty sure it might be done. If the offender has not had lawful intercourse, then the punishment is serious. The accusation has to be made in a month of the offense. And the really hard one is that in order to convict somebody of zina, you need four eyewitnesses to the same sex. So you need to have had sex with somebody with four people watching, all four of whom were adult male Muslims of the nation. And you can also be convicted on a confession, but the confession you need is practice. But it's somewhat ambiguous to what extent the pregnancy is very important. Depends on whether she's got some causal explanation. In particular, there apparently was a doctrine which essentially held that a fetus could remain in suspension for a very long period of time, such that a woman whose husband had died 5 years ago, who suddenly appears pregnant, could claim that it's my husband's son. Second one is a false accusation of sin. So if you accuse somebody of having committed non-approved of sex, and you can't prove it, you are yourself at risk of a punishment of agency. And given the requirement of four adult male Muslim witnesses with good reputation in order to convict, you can see that it can be fairly risky to make such an accusation, because what if it turns out that one of them is Muslim, one of them has a bad reputation and can't be trusted as a witness. There's a special case, proof by way of the accusation was made requires two witnesses, again, Muslims. And to defend against the claim with false accusation, assuming you made the claim, you have to actually convict the person. There's a special case between husband and wife. But this is the issue that the person wants to decide whether the husband denies that the child is denied. And the basic rule is that if the husband accuses his wife of adultery or denies paternity of the child and can't prove it, he can get out of the penalty for false accusation by the appropriate series of oaths. At that point, the wife can then get out of being judged guilty of that by her making a series of oaths, which is not the only case, but as in Jewish law, there are some legal questions that have to get settled. So, this is the only way of contesting paternity. People know what Lord Mansfield's rule is. Lord Mansfield's rule is a rule in English common law which says that a husband may not contest his paternity of a child born by his wife conceived when they were black. But basically says a husband can't accuse his wife of having a daughter who's fair and got pregnant because it's physically possible. Strictly speaking, this really isn't good law in California anymore. It's a little improvements. As we know, there was a case in California some years ago of a child with five parents. Married couple, he is sterile and she is doubly infertile. She can neither provide a viable egg nor bear a fetus. They hire a sperm donor, an egg donor, and a host. And they get divorced. This is now a question for the courts who have parental rights, the right to be. Reading the law literally, the host mother is the mother, because California law said it was the woman whose body a baby was born, and the host mother was married, her husband was the father. In fact, the court more sensibly held that the original couple were the legal parents and therefore right. But anyway, but it's interesting to see the same issue shows up in English common law in the century as Lord Mansfield is, and in the deceased, and in other cases as well, of how you decide whether a child is a child or a father. Alright, the third hot offense is drinking wine. The penalty in three of the four schools is 80 lashes. Like 80 lashes for a free man and 40 lashes for a slave. General rule, incidentally, is that for all of these things, well, the penalty is half. The Quran prohibits wine drinking. That's one of the cases where you've got problems with interpretation, because there are three different parts of the Quran that mention wine, and it's only the last one. The first one actually is a I think part of the interpretive rule, as I understand it, is that you have an opinion about which ones will reveal when, of the last one. Essentially, is that God wasn't being too harsh on the beginning, he loses the dead, so he was imposing, but as the religion became stronger, as it were, he would impose the mercy. The fourth hot offense is theft. This is the one that everybody gets upset about, supposed to cut off the right defender. However, as with stoning the disobedient son, it turns out there are a whole bunch of conditions before you can meet the high offense of theft, so that it looks as though a judge that doesn't want to find the defendant guilty of that do so, and you then pass it to a lower level of plasticity. And then the final one is what's referred to as highway robbery, actually includes both highway robbery and armed entry into drug dealers. And penalty for just doing that, I think, is moving one hand. What? The penalty for doing it, killing somebody is so, and that's where it's interesting, because it's a case in which you've got an effective criminal punishment, whereas the normal punishment for murder is really. Then the next, well, we're out of time. Anyway, so read the stuff you're supposed to read and have fun. I think it's interesting reading the stuff that was written 600-something years ago about a real individual. That's fun for a long time. Think about what questions you want to ask. I'm going to encourage you to work.